Great. So very, very, very warm welcome to everyone. So some of us have been here all day today celebrating this our 50th birthday anniversary. And welcome to those of you who've just joined us. And hello to everyone who's watching this from further afield. My name is Subhadra Metty and I'm part of the team here at London Buddha Centre. And I was delighted to be asked to introduce Subhuti, who is going to give us our main talk for the day. He's going to be doing that in a moment, or a few moments after I introduce him. Subhuti, what I'd like to start by saying is Subhuti has been in our order of movement almost from the beginning, not quite from the beginning, not quite from 50 years ago, but Subhuti has been here from those very early days. And he's been involved in so many different ways. It'd be impossible to say all the different ways Subhuti's been involved and all the different influence that he's had. But for example, he was part of the team who built this place. And when I say built it, this place, the London Buddha Centre, I mean that quite literally. He was actually building and wheeling and dealing of where to get the recycled nails or whatever it was, the second-hand nails that they had to use. So he literally built this place, the London Buddha Centre, and he was chair of this place. These days, he's president of the London Buddha Centre. And that's how I really got to know Subhuti in person, who have been president of this centre. I've been president, it means he visits us twice a year for about a week at a time. And one of the things that I want to, rejoice in Subhuti, although it can be a bit daunting even, is that he thinks bigger than anyone I know. So Subhuti thinks bigger than anyone I know. A few years ago, we members of the LBC Council were on retreat at Subhuti's place in Wales. We do this from time to time. Such a highlight, actually, for me, going for a week's retreat with Subhuti. It's like a Dharma holiday. With all us council members, we study all morning, go for long walks in the Welsh hills in the afternoon. In the rain, we sort of, climb up mountains and, jump over rivers and stuff. So we did that and then watched films in the evening. Very, very nice way to spend a week. Anyway, on one of these occasions, I had been studying with Subhuti in the morning, and the study was coming to an end. And so we said to Subhuti, what do you think is the next step for us at the LBC? What do you think is the next step? And I'm about to smile and he remembers this. And I think we thought, I don't know what everyone else thought, but I thought, well, you'd probably say, maybe you should put on a few more classes or maybe start another residential community or something of that scale is what I was imagining. Subhuti, without sort of pausing for breath, said, I really think you should start to consider what is a nation to build itself on. So that was his answer to us. And then he proceeded to give this whole critique of democracy. You were all writing it down. Myself, might be better writing it down. And then I suddenly realised, goodness, are we really going to do this? So that was what we were doing. So basically, you think you'll get a kind of bite-sized answer. You get this huge answer. And I think the thing is with Subhuti, this isn't just sort of armchair theorising. I think this is the thing I really seriously want to rejoice in. That Subhuti, it's not just that he thinks bigger, he acts bigger. So Subhuti really does consider these questions and put things into practice to address these questions. So I'm thinking particularly of Subhuti's work in India. Subhuti spent 6 months of the year in India. I mean, really, teaching the Dharma, but teaching the Dharma in India really means really helping people to address the social conditions of their whole lives. It really is questioning what is a nation to build itself on. And Subutu also works in Hungary with the Roma community there in very similar ways. So that's the first thing that I learned about Subutu, is just that thinking and acting big. But what makes that quality very special is combined with another quality, which is attention to the individual. I was asking a friend of mine, a Bayan Andy, the other day. I said, I'm going to be introducing Subutu. What do you think? What quality stands out for you? And she paused for a moment and she said, Subutu makes so many people, well, Subutu has a special connection with so many people, and they feel the impact of that special connection. And I thought, yes, that's true. And all week I've been thinking and watching to see why is that true. And what I've noticed with Subutu, I've been paying particularly attention to it this week, is the amount of time and effort Subutu takes to understand each individual. So if you're in a group of people with Subutu, what you'll notice is he sort of doesn't rest until he's understood what someone's question is, what their concern is, where they're coming from. He really doesn't rest until he understands that. And I think that's why so many people feel this special connection. And I feel it myself, and I think because Subutu does that, he takes the time to understand me, he takes the time to understand others. Subutu is someone who sticks up for you. So Subutu will stick up for you as a friend. He's done this with me personally. But the thing is, he sticks up for the other person as well. So that's quite rare, isn't it? So it's not just taking sides in a sort of partisan way. It's like he understands you, but he understands the person you're arguing with as well. And really, he's really committed to that, as far as I can see. He's really committed to that. So do you see how these two qualities go together? Each on their own would be good, actually, would be good on their own, but I think it's the combination of those qualities that make, for me, Subutu so remarkable. And then there's the third quality, which is Subutu's both depth of insight into the Dharma, depth of insight into life, and his skill in communicating that. I know with a speaker, you're not supposed to set them up and say, like, they're really a good speaker. And not to say that when I hear Subutu teaching, it's got that quality, isn't quite the right way of putting it. I was going to say, of making difficult things seem easy. That's not quite what I mean. What I mean is that he can communicate the Dharma, the truth, to anyone. You know, whether there's someone, I'm sure, someone who's been practicing Buddhism for 40 or 50 years, or someone who's just walked in the door of a Buddhist center. So Buddha can take the truths of life, take the Dharma, and communicate them to us. So I think these three qualities in Subutu are why I look forward to his visits here at the London Buddhist Centre with great anticipation. I, with others, benefit from them after the event, as it were, kind of unfolding all the things we've learned from Subutu, and why I'm really absolutely delighted to welcome him here today to speak to us on our 50th anniversary. So let's welcome Subutu.
Thank you very much indeed. Supadramati, it wasn't too embarrassing. It doesn't set me up too much. But dear brothers and sisters, Priyabhai or Bhino, and all our Dhamma brothers and Dhamma sisters all over the world who are, I hope, with us right now. I'm very pleased indeed that I've been asked to address you on this particular occasion. And I'm very grateful to the chairs of the London Centres to have given me this opportunity. I'm a little humbled by it, because it's rather an important one, if you see what I mean. It's a big talk, a big occasion for a talk. So I'm very grateful to you for having that confidence in me. Assuming you did. I'm sure you did. It's an interesting anniversary, a 50th anniversary, because there are still people alive who were around in the earliest days. I myself first came along in 1969, so when I came along, the movement was already hundreds of years old, as far as I was concerned. That's the way it seemed to me. But actually, it was only 2 years old. So I've been around for 48 years in Tree Radman. And I do remember the early centre and the early origins of the movement, although I wasn't around when the actual event took place. The event was, have we ascertained the date? The 6th of April 1967, remember 1967, in a basement in central London near Seven Dials, Monmouth Street. It's a centre of the rag trade. It was in Victorian times. It's an interesting sketch by Boz of Monmouth Street. But now it's a rather more upmarket centre of the rag trade. And 14 Monmouth Street, I believe now, is a dress shop. At that time, it was a tiny little shop. It was a Zen shop, which of course meant it didn't sell anything. And at the back, there was a winding staircase, quite narrow, very narrow. I remember there was a footprint on the ceiling with a swastika on it, which was a bit problematic. It was the other way around, but I didn't know that at the time. And right down in the basement, about the size of the cloakroom here, was a shrine room. And the other side, about half that size, a small reception room, and somewhere down the back there, a toilet and a little kitchenette sort of thing. That was it. And when I first went along, I think there were probably 20 people there. It was really crowded. The Sangharaksha there in all his majesty, exactly the same as he is today. Extraordinary. I saw him just a couple of weeks ago. And although he's 91, pushing 92, he's exactly the same as when I first remember him. The same quality of depth, and mindfulness and presence and ironic wit and sharp clarity and very great interest in engaging with people, just the same. Of course, he hasn't got the same energy, and he can manage for 45 minutes and then he has to have a rest. In those days, he's just absolutely indefatigable. So I go back to those days. I don't go back right to the origins. But there are a few around, actually none of those who are around in that earlier period. The next earliest I can see is David Mitra. It was a couple of years later, I think. Domadina, who you all know, Mangala, they were both around at that time. I came before them. It was a few important weeks. you still know people from those earliest periods, and you know people from the years that come after, the decades that come after. So when we talk about the 50th anniversary, we're talking about near history, almost not history, more like personal memory. When in another 50 years' time you celebrate the 100th anniversary, I'll be here, I think, in the creche. So you'll notice me immediately. I'm trying to take charge. I'm sure I won't be around this particular incarnation at that time. But you know, many of you may be, particularly the younger ones, you may be. But it'd be a very different experience. You'll know people who were around, who knew people who were around in those earliest days, but you will not yourself have any direct acquaintance with them. And so they have a very different relationship to the early days. The 100th anniversary is bound to be somewhat mythic, as it were, the early period is bound to be the lost in the mist of history and only drawn in bold outline. But you know the stories, you've met the people who are behind those stories, you have a much more intimate acquaintance with the earlier 50 years. So I think a 50th anniversary requires a different kind of reflection than later anniversaries are bound to do. Good heavens, at the 1,000th anniversary, I can't imagine what that will be like. I'm sure it'll come. And no doubt some of us will be back for the whatever time. I'm still trying to get ordained. I didn't mean to make it. Keep yourself under control. But, so the 50th anniversary requires a different sort of relationship to the past. And I suppose, particularly topically, we're hearing some of the darker sides of the earlier period and the more unfortunate experiences that people had. So we need to have a relationship to them that is honest, truthful and constructive, creative. So it occurred to me that the first thing we need to do, first thing I need to do, and I suggest, dear brothers and sisters, the first thing that all of you need to do is forgive. I think that's the only way we can relate to a difficult past, and that is bound to be a difficult past, because we're human beings. We're human beings who do not know ourselves especially well, who are trying to discover ourselves and who are coming into a closer and more deep relationship with each other. So forgiveness, I think, is of the essence of a 50th anniversary. We need to forgive those who've caused us any harm. We need to forgive those who've caused harm which has indirectly affected us, and we need to ask for forgiveness. And it's very, very striking that on the 30th of December, our teacher and founder, Urgyen Sundaraksha, issued a personal statement in which he asked us for forgiveness. And I think that's very significant. He's saying that the time has come, as we come to the 50th anniversary, we need to rededicate ourselves to the three jewels. And then he goes on to say in that context about his own personality and how that's affected the movement. But he then asks for forgiveness, which is an extraordinary thing to do. And one that I think we need to take very seriously. We need to think, can we forgive him? If I have no reason to forgive him personally, he's not harming me in any way, but there are those who feel he has, or whether directly or indirectly. So we need to think, can we forgive him? But we need to think about all the people who've harmed us over the years, whether, as I say, directly or indirectly, and see whether we can forgive them. And we need to ask for forgiveness ourselves. In a way, we even need to forgive ourselves. Forgiveness is a vital element in Dhamma life. I think forgiveness strikes very, very deep into the Dhamma. When you forgive, you relinquish a natural human reaction. When, as clinging to self, when somebody offends you in one way or another, transgresses against you in one way or another, the natural, instinctual response is of resentment, of anger, even of revenge. It's built in. It's an animal instinct. You could say that when we become self-conscious, becomes, as it were, manipulative and amplified. So the holding of grudge the feeling that we've been harmed and blamed to others for doing so is a natural human response. We cannot be, as it were, immediately blamed for it. It's just built into us. I've seen dogs, for instance, holding grudges, if you see what I mean. They take in the threat that's come to them and they hold on to it and then they bark at something else, usually, which is what we often do. So it's completely understandable, completely natural. Every one of us, we're honest, but of course we're honest. When we introspect, we'll see that we hold feelings of resentment or grudge to a greater or lesser extent. I've had a very privileged life, so I haven't tended to do that. I haven't suffered much in my early life. But even then, I've held on to a grudge or two, long past its sell-by date. But it's completely part of clinging to self, of having an idea of yourself as something special and unique that should be, the world should go its way, the world should support it, the world should not thwart it. Completely natural. So when you decide that you are going to forgive, it's to that extent a transcendent act. In the act of forgiveness, you give up your self-clinging to a little extent. You just let it go to a little extent. And I've myself experienced it being a very big thing when I have let go of a deep resentment, when somebody, objectively speaking, had genuinely harmed me, and acted in a way that caused me a lot of problems. And I remember, so I'm actually on a solitary retreat, I carried this grudge into a solitary retreat, and Robbie Burns, nursed his grudge to keep it warm. I definitely nursed it. This is for Subhadravati. I nursed my grudge to keep it warm. And not only did I nursed it to keep it warm, but I'd actually helped it to grow. I'd worked on it, and I'd added things that he'd done that the poor fellow hadn't even thought about doing. I'm sure he would if he thought about doing it. And I found myself resenting things that I'd only imagined that he might do. I'm not unique, I'm pleased to say it. And eventually I just realised I've got to let this go. And I sort of reached down deep into myself, and it's difficult to say precisely how, I just let it go. And it did stay gone. I remember the feeling of intense release and freedom as I let it go. I felt suddenly the skies open, the sun come out, outlines become sharper and clearer, a beauty enter my world. So if we can forgive, we transcend ourselves to that extent. Actually, forgiveness goes even deeper. It goes to the depths of reality itself. It goes to the point where we are incapable of being offended. We get to the point where nothing can touch us because we let go of anything that can be touched. This is one of the ways in which you can interpret that mythic story of the Buddha, the attack of Mara on the Buddha under the tree at Bodh Gaya. I interpreted it another way the other day, related, where the Buddha takes the arrows that Mara fires at him and turns them into flowers. Well, he hasn't turned them into flowers, it's just when they come into his aura, they just turn into flowers. That is transcendent forgiveness. It is forgiveness beyond forgiveness. It's the point at which there's nothing in you that can be offended. Because you're not clinging to anything. Offence, taking offence, feeling resentment, feeling hurt, is to do with defending that ego identity, to trying to hold on to it and to punish or to threaten, to deal with what has transgressed it. So forgiveness strikes very, very deep in Dhamma life. And I think that it's a practice in its own right. It's a practice that ultimately is an insight practice, but it's an insight practice in the context of bodhicitta, of the bodhisattva life. The bodhisattva forgives all. The bodhisattva cannot be harmed. Whatever harm comes to the bodhisattva transforms into value for the other. So when I say that I think in our 50th anniversary we need to forgive as the most fundamental of our responses, of course different people will have different relations to the things I'm going to say, but all of us need to forgive so much from the past. Within the movement, without the movement, but especially within the spiritual community. Without forgiveness, no spiritual community. And in doing that, we're helping to build Sangha, but we're also fulfilling our commitment to the three jewels, our going for refuge to the three jewels. So, I think that's a very, very pertinent reflection for a day like this, especially while we're having another bout of introspection about our past. We need to view it in that light. Of course, it's not just that you forgive and forget. I remember Bhante saying that, in fact, that he forgave but he did not forget. What I understand by that is that you let go of the egoistic reaction, but you learn from what happened. You look into what happened and you learn from it, and you try to make sure it doesn't happen again. So again, topically, we now know that Kalyanamitrata and sex is a potentially toxic brew. We know that. It might seem strange, it seems obvious now, but in the 1960s it certainly didn't. But we've learned that. So we need to both forgive and to understand. We need to see what's happened to learn the lessons from it in the light of the Dhamma. It's not just a question of forgiving our past, our last 50 years, although it certainly is that. Maybe especially for those of you who didn't participate in that past, you have to forgive us lot. You have to, sorry, that's not quite we ask you to forgive us, and I hope you do. Because I think if you can't forgive us, you can't benefit from what little we did achieve, or what we did achieve. Let's not belittle it. If you can't forgive us, well, your experience of what we did in helping to set up this movement will be obscured by your sense of the damage, as it were. So without forgetting the damage, without ignoring it, without pretending it didn't happen, you forgive and you learn the lesson and you try to build that then into the life of the community. Although I think in the early years of the movement it was pretty chaotic, wonderfully chaotic as well as awfully chaotic. It's hard to explain to those who did not live through the 60s and to some extent the 70s just what they were like. For somebody of my generation, I was born in 1947, and I sort of came of age with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and LSD and all that. We discovered Timothy Leary and and Pink Floyd, the real Pink Floyd before Syd Barrett left them. etc. Jimi Hendrix. Oh, stop! I met Jimi Hendrix in New York. Anyway, incredibly creative period, and also extremely chaotic and destructive. I had many friends who damaged themselves seriously with drugs. I saw many people who got sexually transmitted diseases or just got themselves completely burned out because they lost all boundaries in sex. But it was a time of enormous experimentation, exploration, we kicked out our poor old parents who'd won the war, and without any gratitude, we just kicked them out and grew our hair long, even though they didn't like it, or got our skirts short, even though they certainly didn't like it. The longer our hair got, the shorter the our friends' skirts got. And really quite brutal. I really feel sorry for the way in which I treated my own parents. They were very good parents. But, you know, it's this sudden change in culture and attitude and atmosphere. We just threw it all out. And the movement came out of that. Much that's really good came out of that. But we also really did a lot that was harmful to ourselves and to each other. And that you, dear friends, have inherited some of the outcome from. Sundarajan himself was, of course, 42 when the movement was founded. But he himself was exploring. For a start, he was gay in London, at a time when it was completely illegal and seriously penalised. He was a monk in India for 20 years. He's sort of discovering a side of himself that hadn't been possible for him to do before, in this atmosphere that anything goes. And, there's much that was creative about that, but there's also much that has left its traces in the movement. So we do ask for your understanding, us who were there and caused some of your problems. We do ask for your understanding, we ask for your forgiveness, that in our struggle to create a new movement, with nothing, there was hardly any Buddhism in 1967. I was dimly aware of three or four other groups. Began to come in very fast after that. But now, you've got so many different Buddhist groups around. There was almost nothing at that time. And what was so appealing about Sangharakshita and the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order was that he seemed to completely embrace this new culture. He wasn't afraid of it. He welcomed it. He tried LSD himself. Pretty clearly not recommending it, if you see what I mean. But he tried it. He listened to Bob Dylan. Didn't think much of him. Oh well, got to forgive him that as well. he embraced our world and connected with us in a way that was completely exceptional for grey straights. You know what that means. Somebody over 30. Probably 25, actually, who just was part of straight society. We used to make that distinction. Straight then mean not hip, not the drug culture, as it were. So it actually sort of embraced it. He enabled us to connect with him. He let us in fully. And he sort of talked our language without ever compromising with it. We were really confused, chaotic, at this particular juncture of Western culture. I think something similar is beginning to happen in India, this radical breakdown in relations between the generations. I had nothing in common with my parents, where I've noticed my friends occupy the same culture as their own children. They listen to the same music and so forth. The children have got good taste to go back to the old ones. We had this absolute radical break, which was tremendously freeing, but meant that our maturation was a little odd, if you see what I mean. If you've got a healthy culture, you mature within that healthy culture, which has ways of sort of taking you on to the next level in a healthy way. That wasn't there. We kicked it out. We destroyed it. We did the exact opposite. And the movement started in all of that. So things that started off with some helpful edge and got sort of blown out of proportion. But it took some time for that to be purged. So yeah, we need you to forgive us, and to then I think you need to realize you're going to do it too. You won't do it in the same ways, but a spiritual community, a Dhamma community, is inevitably a junction between ordinary human beings with quite a high degree of self-unconsciousness, not really knowing ourselves, quite a lot of habits from the past, quite a lot of blind spots, of course, for many of us, complex psychological issues to be dealt with. At the same time, we're in relation to high ideal, the highest ideal that can be. I speak as a Buddhist. An ideal that isn't just a sort of formula, a set of words, an ideal that is some sort of living, felt reality. The Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. The Buddha is not just a sort of historical guy who lived 2,500 years ago, but if you connect with the Buddha, as I've been saying in my recent rambles, you're connecting with a consciousness, a quality of consciousness that is transcendent. You're connecting with the Dhamma, not as a formulation of teaching, but there's a deep felt reality that is, in a sense, alive. I'm speaking metaphorically, but only just metaphorically. It's better to think of it as alive than as dead. You're connecting with a sangha, which is not the literal sangha of, you know, our movement or whatever. It's an ideal sangha. There's the perfect human community of all those who've realized the Dhamma through the Buddha. So you're connecting with that and having a real felt connection with that. That's what I found when I immediately connected with the Dhamma, that it was something alive for me. It was almost visible. It was visible at times in the visionary sense. Something tangible, something I felt in my bones. So you're in contact with that, and you're also an unregenerate, rather immature, 21-year-old, in my case. That's good for you. And you're trying to bring the one into relation with the other so that you're transformed, and you're more or less successful. Sometimes you mistake for the Dhamma what is not the Dhamma. Sometimes you impose your own personality upon the Dhamma. And sometimes it's just complicated because each of us is a separate and different human being with our own complex psychologies and life experiences, conditionings and so forth. And it gets really complicated. It will not stop being complicated, brothers and sisters. The business of having a sangha is not... one that can avoid all harm to each other. It's I think, inevitable. I hope you won't make the same mistakes that we made. I hope you will learn from our mistakes, and I hope that you will forgive us. And then I hope when you make your own mistakes, or people make mistakes for you, you will forgive them, and they will forgive you. So... I think we need to take that on board, that part of what being a Sangha is this struggle to transcend our narrow personalities and our self-clinging, and the harm that inevitably does. Ego-clinging inevitably means coming up against somebody else's ego-clinging, and that inevitably produces pain at some point. So our Sangha has to grow through facing that creatively, and one of the most important things we have to do is forgive. So, yes, at this 50th anniversary, and let's just start there. We could have started in another, I'm going to tell you three things that I think we need to concentrate on, but I think let's start with that in the circumstances, it's a bit topical. Let's start with forgiveness. If we can't forgive, then... we will not be able to do what is then necessary, which is feel gratitude. Without forgiveness, there cannot be gratitude. Let's take Bhante, for instance. as I say, I've never had anything to forgive him for, personally, and nothing he's done has harmed me, whether directly or indirectly. I think I've probably harmed him. I think I've reacted to him. I've, in detail, I'm going to give you a catalogue. But if I feel resentment towards him, if I feel unhappy with him in some way, I cannot then feel gratitude to him, and I cannot benefit from what he has given me. So forgiveness, I think, is an inevitable accompanier of gratitude. If you can just feel gratitude without anything to forgive, so much the better. Somebody else will need your forgiveness. But if you can feel gratitude, you can only feel gratitude if you're able to forgive. If you can't feel gratitude, you cannot benefit. This is pretty obvious when you think about it. When you see that something has benefited you, you feel gratitude for it. And the benefit that it's done you is sort of valued, if you see what I mean. If you can't feel gratitude, you don't value what you've gained. If you don't value what you've gained, it doesn't work for you. So, for instance, for me at least, Sangha I got from Bhante, and then from everybody else who got it from him. Sangha has been probably the principal practice of my life through practicing Sangha, which is not always an easy one, through practicing friendship with others, through sticking with others, even when I don't like them, and they're awkward and difficult and transgress against me, sticking with them, I've grown to the extent that I have. So I'm deeply grateful to Sangharakshita for the notion of Sangha that he's brought alive, which is quite different from that which is generally understood, and for the form that he's given that. So if I can't feel grateful for him, to him, for bringing that about, I can't really fully appreciate what it is, and therefore I can't fully benefit from it. It won't fully work for me. So gratitude is considered in Buddhism one of the most important virtues to cultivate, because gratitude leads to, or is connected with, a real perception of value. If you perceive value, you feel gratitude for whatever has brought that value to you, whatever has enabled you to experience that value. So, it's very simple. We need to feel gratitude. Gratitude to, I think it's unavoidable, to Sangharakshita, to Bhante. Even if we feel we must forgive him. For whatever it is that we feel that he's done, has harmed us or harmed others. We need to forgive him, then we can appreciate what he's given us and feel gratitude for it. What he's given us is really quite extraordinary, and I'm sort of obliged on a day like this just to remind us of what it is. I was thinking about where to start. And I remembered that in 1950, just after he'd received his Tramnera ordination, his Indian teacher, Jagdish Kashyapji, Bhikshu Jagdish Kashyap, took him on tour, holy places and a number of other places, and then up into the Himalayas to Kalimpong. And after they'd been there for a little while in a Buddhist vihara there, he just told him, "I'm going back to the plains, I'm going to go into the jungle to meditate and see what my next move is in life. And I want you to stay here and work for the good of Buddhism." The way Bhante always quotes it is he just said, "Stay here and work for the good of Buddhism." And Sangharakshita had made a sort of vow that he would just do whatever Kashyapji asked him to do. So it was very difficult because Kashyapji was a very unassuming man and always asked him what he should do, if you see what I mean. But So he took very, very seriously this injunction from his preceptor to stay in Kalimpong and work for the good of Buddhism. And reading his memoirs, it's very clear that's just been the guiding principle of his life. He didn't stay there in the end, but he stayed here, as it were, and worked for the good of Buddhism as best he could, given the material that was around him. And if you read those early memoirs, he had some pretty strange companions and worked pretty well with them, at least by his own account. We'll have to listen to that someday. But he seems from that point on to have completely dedicated his life to the good of Buddhism. And one thing I've really noticed with Bhante, he's told me this quite explicitly, that he's never planned what he's going to do. He's never sort of set out with, I know what, in 1967 I'm going to go to England, I'm going to start in a small basement a new Buddhist movement called Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, and it will one day be changing its name if you're at the London Buddhist Centre, the West London Buddhist Centre, etc. Don't think like that at all. It's as if he's connected to the Dhamma, for my purposes, very deeply indeed, and simply allows that to express itself appropriately within whatever circumstance he finds himself. So he works with what's in front of him and allows the Dhamma to work through him. And as he's pointed out recently, of course, he's also got a personality, which to some extent means that it's going to take this form, not that form. For instance, he's never been much interested in science. His interests are mainly literary and cultural. So that's quite strongly affected the movement, and he suggests maybe we need to sort of round that out at some time. Maybe there are also features of his personality that in themselves are quite innocent, but play out in a certain way. He's always, if you meet him, he's always sort of slightly outside the situation, which doesn't mean that he's not completely present. He is very, very reflective. So if you ask him something, you won't necessarily get an answer immediately. We often won't get an answer immediately, but you'll hear the answer 3 or 4 weeks later from somebody else who's told him about it. So it's easy for one such as me, at least, always to get into an immediate dialogue with him. I think it's innocent. I think it's just a question of character. We all come with a character. Mine is as plain as anything to everybody. And you can't help it. It's all right. It's completely innocent. You're this shape, not that shape, if you see what I mean. And half the task of Dhamma life is to use that in a way that's constructive and not destructive. But it takes quite a lot of skill. I think I'm just beginning to realise what I'm like. Everybody else realised a long time ago. But I'm just beginning to work it out. Anyway, I won't go into that. I'm endlessly fascinated as I am. Yes, he had to sort of, he works with the situation, being himself, but deeply inspired by the Dhamma. I believe by bodhicitta, I think that's the best way to put it, by the mind of the Buddha as an active force. But it has to work through him, sometimes even, as it were, slightly against him. But he's sort of let it unfold, and what he has unfolded, at least for many of us, for most of us here, I imagine, is extraordinarily appropriate, extraordinarily approachable, has its defects and problems, but it's amazing how clear and effective it is. Like principles, Bhante has always been very, very clear about principles. So he's always put principles, so to speak, before strategies, which I've learnt a huge amount from, being a man who wants to drop out of the sky and start shooting. I've learnt to stand back and look for a little while before you come up. So we owe, what I'm trying to get at is, we owe to this man a huge debt. But he had the courage, the confidence, the inspiration, the vision, to start such an extraordinarily clear and open version of the Sangha, which relates to the deepest principles of the Dhamma. Very interesting, I've just written the foreword for A Survey of Buddhism, which was his first major piece of writing. And what I realised in writing that is that in A Survey of Buddhism, which was published in 1957, so 10 years before the movement was started, he'd sort of laid out the essential principles upon which the movement is founded. Not some of them had more working out to do, some things he's modified his views on, but he's sort of thought deeply about the nature of the Dhamma, felt deeply the nature of the Dhamma, experienced deeply the nature of the Dhamma, and then lived that out in community with others, who's brought in to share it with him. So, what I'm really getting at, and I need to cut myself short a bit, is that we owe him an incalculable debt of gratitude, which we can only pay if we forgive. But actually, we owe quite a lot of debt of gratitude to a lot of other people. I was thinking that quite a lot of people who have gone, and you may never know about, for instance, just coming in here, you know, I remember the building project that we had here in 18, I can't remember, a long time ago. And for instance, you know, you've got these hangings here, which were made by Dhammacharini Anjali, who died just a couple of years ago. This plinth on which the Buddha sits was made by Dhammacharya Alia, who died a couple of years ago. A lot of the plastering work and the plasterboarding and so forth was done by Dhammacharya Punya, who's gone, went 10 years ago or more. So lots and lots of people who've contributed that we don't know about, that you may never know about. Lots and lots of people. Some people have left the order that gave so much to it. Like a lot of the design for the first design was done by ex-Dhammachari Devaraja. So on and so on. We could go on and on. So many people have contributed to what Sri Ratna is today. My own generation did a lot, and a lot of us kept on doing it. You have our mistakes also to deal with, but we did our best in the circumstances, and I shouldn't have to say this, but you're fortunate to inherit that. So there's over the years so many people inspired first by Sangharakshita have created this extraordinary Sangha, which is now all over the world, all the time. I don't know, I think they're over there, my brothers and sisters in India, who have such deep gratitude for what they've got. I'm going to read you a WhatsApp message. That's the main medium of communication with India. This is probably... you can see why the new generation has to take over. This is from a Dhamma Mitra from North India, who's had a very, very, very painful and difficult life. Partly to do with cars, partly to do with very bad treatment. Her husband was murdered. And a really horrible life. But she came into the movement about 3 or 4 years ago. And what's outstanding about her is that she's just full of gratitude. Her name is Amla Shiel. But she writes, "Hello, I wish you a very happy 50th anniversary of TBNS. In those 50 years, a big revolution has taken place, the revolution which has touched thousands of lives and changed them forever. I've seen people living a beautiful, happy, non-superstitious, this is important in India, rational, again important in India, peaceful, joyful life in the Sangha. Bhante has given us that which couldn't be given by anyone in this world. He has made the approach of Buddhism in such a practical and modern form that no one in 2,500 years could have done. He has driven the vision of Balasaheb to us. Without Bhante, we could hardly succeed to understand Balasaheb. Balasaheb is Dr. Ambedkar, who led the conversion movement in 1956 of millions of people who had formerly untouchable Dalits. And she's from that community. So what people feel in India is that Baba Saheb, Dr. Ambedkar, made the conversion. He took the step into Buddhism and didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to practice. They didn't know how to form Sangha. So this is what Amnashi was saying. I feel proud, uplifted, lucky, and liberated when I think of Bhante, that I am the part of such a beautiful Sangha. I feel I would not have got such a beautiful life of freedom where I could practice the human virtues of compassion, equality, and freedom without Sangha. I would have not learned how to be skillful, how to eradicate unskillful me. I would have not learned how I can be free from all the forms of suffering of life without Sangha. All I can say is I am blessed. Thank you, Bhante. Thank you, my Kalyana Mitras, and all the practitioners who with their efforts made me feel that my life is worthwhile, my life is important. So I've just chosen a single voice, and chosen a voice from India, because Indians have no difficulty with gratitude. We really could learn a lot from them. No difficulty with gratitude, no difficulty with reverence. But I could choose many voices from allow ourselves to feel with the same intensity as my dear friend Amlashil does, our gratitude to those who created the Sangha, which has given us opportunities we could not have had. For myself, I'm pretty sure that I would have made a very big mess of my life if I had not come across the Sangha. I don't know in what way. I can think of several different possibilities, and probably it would have been all of them. I know that I would have made a horrible mess of myself. I had a deep, deep need for something that only the Dhamma could fulfill, and only the Dhamma in the Sangha could fulfill. So I hope that on this occasion we follow this through in deeper and deeper detail, that we're remembering all our ancestors, all those who've contributed, all those who've made possible whatever it is that we get from the Sangha, and forgiving them whatever harm they may have done, whether directly or indirectly to us or to others, just experience our deep gratitude to them. So there's one more quality I think we need to reflect on this occasion. In a way, forgiveness and gratitude are about enough, aren't they? If we could really feel those, everything else would follow. But when we look back, we see how much has been done. It's quite incredible when I think about what I encountered when I went down into that basement. Just a few hippies and a guy in slightly grubby robes with great big mutton chop whiskers and many rings on his fingers. It's something sort of dangerous about it because he just could not be categorized. That's what it was. I just walked into that. I had no idea what it meant. I remember the first meditation I had, I hit dhyana, which took me years to hit again. We kept question and answer session afterwards where this man just so easily and naturally and openly just made the Dhamma plain in a context of deep appreciation of Western culture. But that's what it was. You could not have imagined what we have today 50 years ago, or at least 48 years ago. And Bhante himself says he finds it incredible what has happened, and he says that he knows that he didn't do it. Not just in the sense that others contributed to it, but that it was something, as it were, greater working in and through him to create it. The Dhamma, a living Dhamma, the bodhicitta, a living bodhicitta working through him, now working amongst us. So, yes, it's incredible. But, dear brothers and sisters, we've not finished. We definitely haven't finished. I'm almost finished. The race is now downhill for me. I'll be lucky I might be unlucky if I'm around in 20 years, which I view with complete equanimity, I should say. Maybe I'll be around in 120 years, but I probably won't remember anything if that's the case. But yes, it's not really in my hands. I feel that my day is done. And that just as I and my friends, Deva Mitra and others, laid the foundations on the basis of Bhante's inspiration, it's now for all of you, particularly the younger amongst you, to lay the foundations for the next stage. It's going to be different. I probably won't like it. But I probably will tell you that when I come to your creche. It's going to be different. It's a very different world to the world that I, the movement came out of. So much has changed. But I believe that actually it's more crucial than it's ever been before. Subhadra Mati mentioned my saying, I can't remember what it was, it was wonderful. I wish I could remember it. What was it? How do you build a nation?
How do you build a nation?
Something like that. Well, what I meant was that if we are to change this world, we have to implant in this world a completely new vision. Societies are not governed by law. Law helps. They're not governed by methods of selecting a government. They're not governed even by governments. That's pretty obvious. What drives society is their underlying values, their underlying perspective on life, their understanding of the meaning of human existence, their understanding of what is right and what is wrong. And this great insight comes initially from Dr. Ambedkar, and Bhante has picked it up very strongly, that the duty, our duty for the future, is duty too dirty a word? Anyway, if it just translate, I'm now going back before my 1960s inheritance, my naval officer father. But duty, I don't think, is a dirty word. I think what it means is your recognition of what needs to be done. And once you know what needs to be done, if you're at all honourable and integrated, you must do it. So it's that feeling, that's what needs to be done. I can see it. I must help to do it. So our duty is to create a deeper vision for the whole of society, a deeper ethical vision for the whole of society. And my goodness, does it need it? We're vividly aware of that at the moment, with this strong reaction against the liberal consensus, which perhaps probably had to happen. It's been waiting to happen. Liberalism is not enough, and there needs to be a much deeper basis for a good society. And that the only basis, I think, is in deep moral and spiritual principles, which I believe, as a Buddhist, are best expressed and most clearly and unequivocally and unambiguously expressed in the Buddha Dhamma. So your job, brothers and sisters, I shall watch you from whatever realm I go to. Actually, I'll come back. I'll be here, don't worry. Your job, your duty, is to try to implant this new vision of human life and human society on the basis of the Dhamma into the whole political, social, collective, cultural sphere. We need to make it live in that context, not just as a little corner for alternatives who generally vote left, as it were. It must be much more central, much more essential, and go way beyond party divisions and ideological perspectives. It's something much, much deeper. And I think the next phase of human history is pretty make or break. Every generation thinks this, but it looks to me like it's make or break. I mean, right now, we've got the Americans firing Tomahawk missiles into an ally of the Russians. It's never been this dangerous. In my time, of course, America and Russia had, or Britain too, had mutually assured destruction. But we've not had such a close shooting war in my memory. I suppose the nearest was American backing of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. But it's much, much closer. There are actually Russians there. it's getting ratcheted up all the time, the capacity of technology to amplify destructive power is getting more and more great. But I'm not without hope. I'm not without hope because of the Dhamma. And also just some sort of strange human resilience. But I think our duty for the next 50 years is to live the Dhamma very vividly ourselves, to go for refuge very deeply ourselves, to create together a more and more effective Sangha on the basis of what's already come, to build that far more effectively, far stronger, far more mature, far more multi-layered and multivalent all over the world, and to then transmit that in direct ways by bringing people into centers and teaching them to meditate, teaching them Dhamma, and indirect ways by influencing the world, even through politics, through cultural media, through journalism, in every way we possibly can, to implant this deep, deep vision of what it is to be a human being and what a human society could be. So I'd like to suggest that this is what our dedication needs to be for the next 50 years, this aspiration to make the Buddha Dhamma close to the heart of the world, so that the world's heart beats to the rhythm of the Dhamma, the drum of the Dhamma. And this is what we need to reflect on this occasion. Forgive what has happened before that has been unskillful or harmful. Feel gratitude to those who've made it possible, beginning with Bhante, and always he must be there. And feeling that gratitude very deeply, then we can appreciate. Once we've forgiven, we can feel grateful. When we feel grateful, we can really appreciate. And when we can feel grateful and appreciate, then we can work to put that at the heart of our world that needs it as never before. So, that's your job for the next 50 years, and at the 100th anniversary, one of you will stand here and remember the last 50 years and a plea for forgiveness too, you'll have to, appeal for gratitude and appeal for an even stronger effort to put the Dhamma at the heart of the world. Thank you.
So I'd say thank you on behalf of all of us. In a way, I feel I'm listening to you. I feel runners when I feel. Yeah, I think that's the best word I can use. I think personally, that's what my heart longs for, is that kind of rousing. We're called to do something. I think that isn't just a talk that inspires us, that's a talk that calls us to action. I really feel that I've been called to action, that threefold action, and that we all have. And it's a sort of humbling talk, because I feel like, well, I hope I can fulfil that. Like, I personally, I owe it to the next 50 years to fulfil that, and I'm sure I'm not alone in feeling that. So, yeah, I just feel like very, very grateful, not just for this talk in itself, but for coming to the end of your whole week here, which in itself is of a long line of weeks here. So just really, being with us in this way, calling us to action. Before we thank I'm going to say something myself. I'm going to do is I'm going to launch us. So today, on this occasion, all over the Tree Rattler world, we're launching Tree Rattler 50 to raise money for to start us off in the next 50 years. The whole day, particularly Subhuti's talk, has given us, well, it's really shown us this vision of the Dharma unfolding through Bhante, how the Dharma's unfolded through Bhante and all his disciples and is unfolding. And we've heard through the personal talk some of the personal effects of that. Very, very struck by our first talk this morning from Peter, who just talked about just the effect that the Dharma's had on him in a few short months. Young man coming along to the centre saying that before he came here he felt that the best he could achieve in life was just to be mildly depressed. That was the best he could expect, was that, to be mildly depressed. On encountering the Dharma, he said that he realised how far he had drifted from what he wanted to be. And it was like he was brought back by his encounter with the Dharma, he was brought back. So again, that's just one person. So we heard from the Dharma Mitra in India as well, another single person. They're always the most moving, I find. So you've got this, the Dharma as a sort of, in a way, solution to our personal lives. But also Subhuti has roused us to see, well, how we really need the Dharma in this world of nationalism, religious extremism, and actual and potential violence. And Subhuti has shown us the solution for this as well, that if we work as a Sangha, as we work as a community, if there's enough of us working together to free our hearts and minds of that self-clinging that gets in the way of bodhicitta, that gets in the way of the flow of Dharma, then the Dharma can be alive. It needs to be lived out. It needs to be lived out.